a three-day Scott Carter's conference. And it's lovely to have you here, and please keep your eyes open for the last-minute announcements for the next Nazi Washington, because they usually come in pretty late. And now it's time to enjoy our first speaker in the morning session, Dror Barnatan, who will tell us about the polynomial time, not polynomial, via solvable approximation.
Okay. Thank you for inviting me. And my talk will follow a handout. I think everybody has one already. And my title really is on elves and invariants. So I've changed my title in the last minute. Please forgive me. And, standing here. Okay, wait. And I should say that the things I will say follow work by Lev Rozansky and his student Andrea Overbay. And I think we... and it's all joint with Roland van der Veen. And we have a completely different approach, but at the end we end up computing the same invariant, and I think they also failed to notice how spectacular their work was. So that's another thing that I think we're adding. The acronym W omega epsilon beta is defined here, and there are various further materials in that place. You're welcome to look at it. And I should say that it's work in progress and a little bit fluid, and help is needed. And I should also say that I've given this talk, or no, a variant of this talk, in August in Switzerland in 4 hours, and then several times in between in 2 hours. And now I'm going to try to do it in 1 hour, and therefore I'm going to be a bit blunt or brusque or abrupt, and in particular my abstract is whether or not you like the formulas here, and you're probably not going to like them because some of them are ugly, you cannot not pay attention because they describe the strongest truly computable knot invariant we know. So let me explain. First of all, what does truly computable mean? It means computable in polynomial time, which means that you can compute it, you know, ordinary knot invariants, the Jones polynomial, Homfli-Hovanov homology, you're lucky if you can compute it for, well, you can compute it for knots with 10 crossings, you're lucky if you can compute it for knots with 30 or 50 crossings, sometimes you can do a tiny bit more. Now I'm talking about, but most of these invariants you cannot even compute for 10 crossings. Many of these invariants, at least. And what I'm talking about now is computable for knots, well, it has been computed for knots with 50 crossings using a very, very drafty version of the program, and I expect that it will evolve, and sooner or later I will be able to compute it for knots with hundreds or thousands of crossings. So it's really a completely different game, okay? And when I say strongest, I actually mean that it is stronger than Homfli, Kaufmann, and Hovanov homology taken together. Okay? At least in separation power. But since I'm mostly going to just describe the formulas, let me start with a little bit of philosophy. Where are these formulas coming from? Even though I'm not going to really make the connection. So basically, if you don't know about semi-simple algebras, tune out, okay, for a minute. So the formulas come from the fact that there is some funny rescaling that you can do on semi-simple algebras, and people are not fully aware of it, and I'll explain why in a minute. So basically, if you have a semi-simple algebra, you can think of it as being as the sum of its upper Borel, here in blue, with its lower Borel, here in red, so B plus plus B minus. And in fact, this sum is a little bit more than the whole algebra. You get the Cartan part doubled, but please ignore this. This is not very significant. So it's the sum of the upper Borel and the lower Borel, which means that the bracket can be decomposed into 8 pieces. Namely, you know, input from here, first input from either here or here, so that's 4 choices, and then the output will be in the sum of this and this. So that's again two choices, which part of the output you're looking at. And it turns out that there is a natural way to rescale three of these components by epsilon, multiply three of these components of the bracket by epsilon, and still get a bracket. In particular, you would be multiplying the b minus to b minus, the b minus cross b minus to b minus part by epsilon, and you still get an algebra. And you should be thinking of this algebra as if it's the original semi-simple algebra, say SL2 or SLN, but with the lower Cartan part a little bit faded out, because you've multiplied it by epsilon, which is 1/1000. So you get sort of a weaker lower Cartan behavior. Okay? So why is it that people don't talk about it? So mostly because people don't know. Okay? But there is a second reason, and this is that if epsilon is invertible, so if epsilon is, for example, 1/1000, then you can rescale the generators, you can rescale B minus to counter the rescaling of the bracket, and then you find that you get back to the algebra you started from. So you get an algebra that's isomorphic to the one you started from, so who cares? Okay? But then there is something interesting to do. You can set epsilon to be equal to zero. And then you cannot rescale. This is actually not an isomorphic algebra. And you get something lovely that people hardly ever talk about, but I talk about it a lot. And what you get is precisely the theory of welded knots and their Alexander invariants. And it doesn't matter which Lie algebra you start from, you always get the Alexander polynomial. Okay? So I have a good number of papers on this, partially jointly with Zsuzsanna Dancsó. But what I'm going to talk about today is about something else. So I'm going to say, let's take epsilon such that epsilon to the power k, or k plus 1, is equal to 0. So epsilon itself is nilpotent. And in particular, I'm going to mostly look or only look at the case where epsilon squared is equal to 0. So the resulting algebra comes out to be maybe before that, why haven't people looked at these algebras before? And the answer is basically because Roland van der Veen and myself are lucky bastards. We're lucky, nobody looked at it, we get to look at it first. But why are they good? So first of all, they're in some sense approximation of the algebra you started from. If you start from SLN or SL2, then the bigger K is, the closer the approximation it is to SLK. However, the algebras you get as algebras over Q are solvable. Because if you take too many times the brackets in the B minus side, you get to zero, and you can check that this means that you get a solvable algebra. And solvable means that you can actually write formulas and work with them. Maybe it's hard, but you can. Now, you could say, so that's wonderful. So you could say that, in fact, semi-simple Lie algebras, you could already write formulas and work with them. But that's somewhat a lie, so let me explain. So in semi-simple Lie algebras, it's actually extremely difficult to work directly with formulas written in the universal enveloping algebra. So if you have a semi-simple Lie algebra and you're trying, and you have two elements of the Lie algebra, and you're trying to write e to the x times e to the y as equals to e to the z, so you're trying to find z in terms of x and y, it's actually extremely difficult, nearly impossible. It's a non-linear thing. It corresponds to the group multiplication, but actually doing it algebraically at the level of the Lie algebra is practically impossible. So hence, instead, people use representation theory. So instead of working directly in the universal enveloping algebra, they work using representations. But the moment you put in representations into knot theory, well, you end up having to put a copy of the representation on each strand or on each piece of the knot, and then you have, end up needing to look at tensor power and at tensor products of such representation, so it ends up being tensor powers, but tensor powers of even a two-dimensional representation grow exponentially in size. So you get something computable, but it's computable with extreme difficulty, with very well in exponential time. So and that's exactly where the advantage of what I'm going to tell you about comes in. What happened to the O here? Here it is. Okay. And and maybe one last thing before I start following the handout. Is so in the case of SL2, B plus is often generated by people denote the generator by E, and the B minus, the generator, is often called F. And I told you that the Cartan gets doubled, so one generator is often called H, and then you have no name for the next one because H, I, but I is a small integer, so is J, so is K, here is K. So the next available name to use here is L. And in fact, H turns out to be central, which means that it factors out of all of the formulas. So there is really nothing to worry about when you think about H. And in fact, you replace it by e to the H very quickly, which is equal to which you name T. So everything ends up being about E, L, and F. And now I can start my Christmas-themed talk. Okay, so I'm just going to describe how the invariant is computed. All of this, forget. It's related, it's where it came from, but it's not going to appear. Okay, so how is the invariant computed? Well, there are three steps. Well, first, the first step is preparation. Given a knot, there is a completely routine, simple-minded, linear time, something that you do by hand, way of preparing out of it an ordered pair. The ordered pair is a word, and the word is the word elf, 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 repeated a number of times, as many times as there are features inside the knot. And then the second component of the ordered pair is in fact a formula, but the formula is made of four pieces, omega, L, Q, and P, where each of these is, again, very simple things that you can write directly out of, you can write directly from the knot. That's step one. Step two is you apply rewrite rules. So there are certain rules, which I will describe in a minute, which tell you how you can swap two letters over here, how you can change the order of an L and an F, or an F and an E. And every time you swap two letters here, you have to make a modification to the formulas that appear here. So as you apply these rewrite rules, the formulas get simpler and you can sort the word to something else, but the formulas get more and more complicated. And there is another rule which tells you how to merge two letters. So if you have two E's next to each other, you can merge them to a single E. And so at the end, you can reduce to a single ELF with a complicated formulas here. It turns out that the L part and the Q parts are both zero and not interesting. And so the only part that's interest here is omega and P. This is already a knot invariant. Omega and P already form a knot invariant. Omega is the Alexander polynomial, and P turns to be made of several components, most of which are not interesting, so you have to do some extraction procedure, some readout procedure, where out of omega and P, you read rho 1, and rho 1 is the invariant that is tabulated at the end of your handouts. Okay? So that's the scheme. Are you okay? Scott? Are you okay? Yes.
Yeah.
Are those rewrite rules coming from PBW order instead?
Yes. They come from applying PBW in an effective way. Okay?
So row one is a function of the Alexander polynomial.
No, P is a function of row one in the Alexander polynomial.
Okay.
And basically the readout procedure is to move away, to peel out the Alexander pieces and just be left with the new thing.
Okay.
Okay? So really the invariant is omega and P, or in fact the invariant is the whole quadruple, but the middle two pieces are not interesting. So the invariant is this, but you can simplify the presentation by like applying some simple-minded formula then. Okay? Good. Everything is, of course, implemented, and a fully working demo program is on your handout. So, and also at omega epsilon beta / demo. But the first piece of the implementation is not really interesting. It's just about nice, pretty printing the result. So I'm not going to tell you anything about it, but CF means canonical form, and it prints stuff in a natural form to read. So, you know, let's hit enter here, and this part of the program is now inside, and I can move on to the preparation. So what's the preparation? So first of all, you draw the node K as a zero-framed, zero-rotation number planar diagram. Okay, zero rotation number, I think people know what it is, so I'll just move on. By the way, this is not strictly necessary. I could have worked with not necessarily zero rotation number, not necessarily zero frame things. I would just have to add a little bit to the formulas. So this is not strictly necessary, it just makes the presentation simpler. After you do that, you walk along the knot, and you number all the features that you see. The features are, well, every time you're on an overstrand on a crossing, you assign number to it. So this is overstrand number one. Then you're under here, so this is number two. Okay, the next type of interesting feature is right-headed caps and caps. Okay, so caps and caps where the tangent vector is pointing to the right. So here is a cap with tangent vector heading to the right. So I number it 3, then I have 4, the overstrands, and 5, the unders, and 6. Anyway, 7 is again a cap with the tangent vector headed to the right, and so on. For the trefoil, I had to undo the framing, so I end up with markings that go up to 16. Okay. Just naming, so first of all, caps I called plus quaps. So a quap is a cap or a cap. And then a plus quap is a cap, and a minus quap is a cap. And I think this is actually better than trying to make the pronunciation perfect. And okay, and then if X is a crossing, then there are two markings next to it. So
if something's a quap, then it's a right-handed.
Yes.
Okay.
A quap is always right-handed for this specific presentation.
Yeah.
Okay. So if X is a crossing, then there are two numbers next to it. So say this crossing has 1 and 11. So 1 is the I of the crossing and the overstrand. And 11 is the J of the crossing. So J, IX, and JX are the two labels associated with the crossing. And then there is a sign for the crossing. So it's either a right-handed or a left-handed crossing. So if it's right-handed, I define SX to be 0. And if the crossing is left-handed, I define S of X to be -1. So it's 0 and -1. Okay? Why? Because it makes the formulas simpler. I told you, the formulas are horrible. So I'm doing anything I can to cut the complexity. Okay? Finally, if C is a quap, then I sub C is the label. I have a typo here. It's a single label. And S sub C is its sign, which is plus or minus. Okay? And then I define the triple L, Q, and P to be. So it's the sum over all I, J, and S minus 1 to the S times, and then, so basically it's the sum over all crossing, and for each crossing I take a contribution. So the L part is the L, is the variable L subscripted J. For the Q part, I take T, a variable T. Again, I have variables T, E, H, J, well, all the variables written over there. So I take the T variable raised to the power S, where S is the sign of the crossing, so it's either 0 or minus 1, times E, I, F, J. And then for the P part, I take minus T to the power S, E, I, L sub something funny, I'll return to it in a minute, FJ plus LILJ plus T to the 2S EI squared FJ squared over 4. This thing is just a crazy way of writing that if S is equal to 0, you get I, and if S is equal to minus 1, you get J. So it's either LI or LJ depending on what S is. Okay? But in any case, this is a linear combination of LJs. This is a quadratic combination of EIs and FJs. And this is a quartic polynomial, polynomial of degree 4, in all the things that appear.
Okay, are the subscripts on E and F, are they indicative of elements in the Lie algebras, like the set of all
I don't know anything about Lie algebras at this moment. I forgot about Lie algebras.
Okay.
Lie algebras appeared at the beginning of the talk and then got forgotten. But then the answer is yes, they correspond to things in different tensor factors of the Lie algebra or something. But at the moment, these are just, these are formal polynomials in the variables that are appearing here. And the variables are a single T, one T for all, and then EI, FI, and LJ, EI, LI, and FI, where I run, where the index runs from 1 to 16. Okay?
Do you know a priori the length of the index?
In this case, 16. Basically, the number of crossings plus the number of quaps.
But if I hand you a knot, then you have to compute that initially.
Yeah.
Okay.
But this I do by drawing it on a piece of paper. See I have 15 crossings and I have, 22 quaps. So that's what I get. But it's something that's mechanically easy.
Okay.
In fact, when the actual programs that produce the tables at the end, this is the hardest part. But, okay. And then for each quap, so each quap has an index I and a sign S. And for each quap, I take 0 for the L part, 0 for the Q part, and then for the P part, I just take S times LI. I sum all of these up, and I output, so the output of this stage is the word ELF1, ELF, 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 M times, in this case 16, but really I mean E1, L1, F1, E2, L2, F2, up to EM, LM, FM, and then for omega, I take 1, and for L, I take the for L, Q, and P, I take the L, Q, and P that I've indicated here. Okay? So, for example, here is the implementation. So, the expression corresponding to I, J, and S, so if you have a crossing, it will have an I, J, and an S, the expression corresponding to it is 1, this is the omega part. Then, basically, these are the formulas that I was showing in the previous slide. The expression corresponding to a quap, which is just an I and an S, is this. And again, these are the formulas that I've shown in the previous slide, so there is nothing new. And then if you have two quaps, the way you combine, or two features, the way you combine the expressions corresponding to them is the omega part doesn't change, it remains 1, and the L parts are additive, and the Q parts are additive, and the P parts are additive, just as I've written here. These are sums. So, and the word I just don't indicate, I keep it in my mind. I remember that the word is elf, 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 elf. And here it is evaluated for the trefoil. So for the trefoil, there was a crossing between 1 and 11, and it was a 0 with sign 0, meaning a right-handed crossing. Then there was a crossing between 4 and a 2, and it's a minus, a negative crossing, because that was one of the kings. And so on. I hit enter, and the computer tells me that the result of phase 1, dropping the word elf, 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 is omega is equal to 1, L is this linear combination of L's. Q is this funny quadratic expression up to this comma written in the E's. And P is this horrible polynomial. Okay? But that's the result so far. In general, always, L will be a Z-linear combination of the Li's, Q will be an R-linear combination of the Ei's and Fj, where R is the ring of Laurent polynomials in T. So, and you can see it here, right? There is T raised to some power. And P is an R-linear combination of, well, it's a quartic polynomial, it's a polynomial of degree 4, but in fact, only terms of the following forms can appear in it. So, but really, you don't really need to know that. It's enough that I tell you that it's a quartic polynomial in the variables, polynomial of degree 4. Now, I should say that this is the key to computability. I mean, maybe you think this is extremely awful, but in fact, and again, from a human perspective, these are complicated formulas, but in fact, no matter how complicated the knot was, you are only going to deal with quartic polynomials. Quartic polynomials in 20 variables, there are roughly 20 to the 4 of them. Okay? The number of polynomials of degree 4 grows polynomially in the number of variables you have. So the complexity of our formulas is bounded by a polynomial, as opposed to the complexity that comes out of representation theory, which I've already indicated will involve things like a representation raised to the power n, which grows exponentially. So, I mean, maybe you think this is ugly, but it's actually simple. Okay, comments, questions?
What happened to the, is that 4 in the denominator go away somehow?
Is what? Well, the 4?
Well, P is has integer coefficients, right? Or R.
L has integer coefficients.
No, but P is an R linear combination of these things.
Oh, oops. Oops.
I mean.
So I should have written Q.
Okay, fine.
I should have written Q. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Now I have to start with the rewrite rules. So the rewrite rules, again, I modify the word a little bit, and at the same time modify the formulas, and I do it until I get to the word elf, or more precisely E1, L1, F1, and then I just output the omega and the P that I get at the end. So let me start by the simpler rules. So rule 1, deletions. If a letter appears in the word, but does not appear in the formulas, you can delete it. You actually never use it, but I just stated it to make things appear easy. Okay? Rule 2 is merges. So if in the word you have the same letter appearing twice in a row, but possibly with different subscripts, so you have VI, VJ, where V is either an E or an L or an F, it doesn't matter, then you can replace it by a single instance of the same letter. But you see, inside the formulas, you will have, like, say you have Fi and then Fj. Inside the formulas, you'll have formulas that involve Fi and Fj. So you just identify Fi and Fj and call the result Fk. So, in other words, if in the word part you have Ei, Ej, and then the formulas part is Z, then you can replace it by a single Ek, where K is some arbitrary other index, at the cost of, in fact, that's not a cost, that's a discount, of replacing inside Z every occurrence of EI or EJ by EK. I'm calling it a discount because it reduces the complexity of Z, right? If it's, now Z depends on one variable less, one fewer. You're evaluating Z on a diagonal, so it's a simpler polynomial. There is one tiny condition, and this is that the letter K that I'm using here should not appear elsewhere in the word, just to, so that there are no name clashes. Usually it's easy to arrange. You just create a new index, okay? Just so that there are no name clashes with other parts of the formula. Okay, now we start with the hard formulas. This is the medium hard, and then comes the really hard, okay? So, again, provided K does not introduce name clashes, I can swap an LJEI, so I can, so my goal is to write things as elves. So this is the wrong order. E should be before L in the word elf, right? So I need to tell you how to swap an L across an E. So the rule is as follows. First of all, you take the L part of the formula. This is just a linear combination of L's. And you write it as lambda times LJ. J is this index of the L's that I'm trying to swap. So you write it over as lambda times LJ plus the rest, where lambda is just an integer. And the Q part you write as alpha times EI. So again, EI is the E that involves in the swapping. So what's alpha? Alpha is, by the way, a complicated thing. It's a combination of Fs, right? Because Q is quadratic. So alpha contains in it Fs and further coefficients, which are Laurent polynomials. So alpha is a messy thing. And then plus the rest. So you basically extract the EI part and then Q prime must involve no EIs anymore. Next, you take the quartic polynomial, and it's a quartic polynomial in many, many, many variables. So you think of it as a polynomial in EI and LJ, and think of all the other variables as polynomials, right? So you turn it into a two-variable polynomial with coefficients that are themselves polynomials in all the other variables. And finally, not finally, and then you set lowercase q to be e to the gamma, so this is fancy e to separate it from the e of the variable. So this is the basis of the natural logarithm, this e, okay? So you set q to be e to the gamma beta ek plus gamma lk, whatever, and now you output the result of the rewrite law. What is the result of the rewrite law? Well, first of all, you have moved the L and the E to the correct order, so it becomes EL with the new index, K. And then the omega part doesn't change. The L part, the only change you do is you replace LJ by LK. The Q part becomes T to the lambda is a scalar, times alpha times EK, that's again quadratic, plus Q prime, so that's a very mild change. And then the P part becomes something horrible. Again, you don't have to like it. Even if you don't like it, it's the strongest genuinely computable invariant there is. So don't like it. Anyway, but the P part is the following. You write e to the q. You write the exponential of this thing. And this is a function, in particular, of gamma and of two variables, gamma and beta. Oh, I didn't tell you. Gamma and beta are formal variables that I've just introduced for the purpose of writing q. Okay? So this is a function of the formal variables beta and gamma.
How does K relate to J and I in your switch?
K is a new name, new subscript that I use. It doesn't have, it can be
a new subscript. Just as above, okay, I got you.
Yeah. It can be one of I or J, but it doesn't have to be. And the only rule is that it should not conflict with any of the other names that appear here. Yes, Heather?
How do you know that you can sort of, I mean, it looks like you're trying to sort out the EI bits and the LJ bits.
Yeah.
And they're separate? In P.
In P. Oh, you're right. I'm doing, so later I will need to swap all the other pairs. So I'm going to have three swapping rules. How to swap an E across an L, an E across an F, and an L across an F. Basically. Okay? So this is the first of the three swap rules. Okay. Anyway, so again, I let Q, this formal thing, I look at the exponential of Q, I differentiate it, I take this two-variable polynomial here and substitute in it. Instead of EI, I put the derivative with respect to beta. Instead of LJ, I put the derivative with respect to gamma. Now, this is a, right, this was a quartic polynomial, so this is a differential operator of order 4. When you apply a differential operator to an exponential, basically what it does is it keeps the exponential the same way, and you get the internal of the derivative of Q pulled to the coefficients. So this, and then I multiply by e to the minus Q, so I kill the exponential. So this is back again a polynomial. And it's just a fancy way of writing some algebra, okay? And after I do that, I substitute, so here I get a polynomial which also will involve betas and gammas, because betas and gammas were involved in Q. So I substitute beta is equal to alpha over omega, and gamma is equal to lambda log t. But you see, gamma only appears inside an exponential, so in fact this becomes t to the lambda once you substitute it in. So this is back again a polynomial, and you can check that it's back again quartic. So that was my second rewrite rule. Hate it if you wish, I don't care. Okay, then there is how to sort an F across an L, and I will not go through it. It's exactly the same, precisely the same, with some naming changes, but otherwise it's exactly the same. And in fact, in the implementation, it is so exactly the same that it's implemented only once. So in the implementation, first of all, this is all in Mathematica. So first of all, I have to tell Mathematica how to implement differential polynomials. And this is sort of mess. This is the internal syntax of Mathematica, and you better not know it. The only thing you really need to know is that dp stands for p evaluated at d alpha d beta evaluated on a function f. Again, the specifics don't really matter. And then switching LJ across something which is either an E or an F, across an X which is either an E and an F, is given by the formulas written here. And if you stare at these formulas for a little bit, you'll realize that they are precisely the formulas that I've advertised. So the program does what I said it would do. Okay? Next, the hardest bit. So how do you do an FE? So again, in ELF, E comes before F, so I would like to know how to switch E to the other side of an F. So again, provided K introduce no clashes, if I'm given an FIEJ and then omega LQP, I decompose Q as much as I can. Namely, I write Q is quadratic in the E's and the F, so it's going to have a part proportional to FIEJ. This Fi and this Ej. Then it's going to have a part proportional to Fi, but with no Ejs in it. Then it's going to have a part proportional to Ej, but with no Fi's in it. So that's Qf and Qe. And then it's going to have a part Q prime where all the rest occurs. Then I write the polynomial P, the P part, as a polynomial in Fi and Ej. Again, I make it a two-variable polynomial with messy coefficients. And then I introduce three formal variables, alpha, beta, and delta. and I set mu to be 1 plus t minus 1 times delta, and q to be, again, some combination, 1 minus t alpha beta plus beta ek plus alpha fk plus delta ek fk divided by mu, and then I can output the result. The output is, first of all, I sort the e and the f to the right order. Second, okay, the omega parts get replaced by mu omega, where mu was set here. The L part gets replaced by, the L part is not changed. The Q part gets replaced by mu omega lowercase q, where this is lowercase q, plus mu q prime. Then I have a contribution like before, a differential operator acting on e to the q with the e to the q part removed after the action. And then I do something absolutely horrible, which I add yet another term, omega to the fourth lambda k, and I'll explain lambda k in a minute. The result still depends on alpha, beta, and delta. So I substitute alpha is qf divided by omega, beta is qe divided by omega, and delta is qfe divided by omega. So these three pieces here. And that is my output. Okay? But I still have to tell you what lambda k is. So lambda k is euphemized to logos. It's really a horrible thing, but we call it the logos because it's the principle of order and knowledge. It actually contains in it all the complexity of the Lie algebra I started from. It becomes coded in some polynomial form. So that's lambda k. Total mess, unmemorable. If you'll ask me in the middle of the night to cite lambda, I would not be able to do it. It's only written down here. And the only point here is that it involves only the variables that it allows to allowed to involve. So the EK, FKs, the things that are allowed to appear in the P part here, and delta, mu, alpha, and beta, which are then set to be things that are allowed to appear. Again, I have nothing good to say about it. Okay. Except that it works.
You're not a fan of John the Baptist, I guess.
I don't get the...
In the beginning was the word.
What?
An archaic logos.
In the beginning was the word.
Okay. Maybe you should explain it to me later. I'm just an idiot. Okay. Anyway, here is the implementation. Nothing exciting about it. So first of all, you set the logos at k to be this horrible formula, and then you define the swap of fi with ej to be evaluated on an expression with omega l, q, and p to be, and again, if you look at these things, this is exactly what I told you it is, okay? The only thing that I do is, so for example, I set alpha to be omega inverse, right, before I wrote something divided by omega, now I write omega inverse times, and that something was supposed to be some coefficient of q, so I extract coefficients of q by differentiating with respect to the relevant variables. But basically, it's just what I told you it is. Okay, next. Okay, so now I have all the tools to compute the invariant, right? I can sort my 16 elfs to some order where you have E, 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 L, 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 F, 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 F. Then I can merge the E's and the F's using one of the rules that I gave you, and I got I get a single elf at the end. But there is actually a much cleaner way to do it. And this is elf merges. So if you have E1, L1, F1, E2, L2, F2, I can rewrite it as a single elf by, first of all, I do this swap. So this got swapped with sort of temporary variable on the letters here. Then I swap these two, and I swap these two, and I just get E, E, L, L, F, F. And now I merge the E's and the L's and the F's, so I get a single L, a single elf. And this I repeat. So first I have elf 1, elf 2, elf 3. I change it to elf1, elf3, and so on. Then I merge elf3 to elf1, so I get a single elf1 and then elf4. Then I merge elf4 to elf, elf1, and so on. So I just merge all the elves in order.
At the level of the knot diagram, you're doing some sort of skein manipulation.
No, it's not a skein manipulation. It's multiplying in some algebra. Okay? So here's the implementation. Merging elf I with elf, elf j, calling the result elf k, is taking your z and applying one swap, then the other swap, then the last swap, and then identifying all the variables. Okay? And in fact, if you remember, I've already set z1 to be the result of the preparation phase applied to the trefoil. So now I tell my computer to set z1 to be z1 with elf1 and elfk merged and with the result called again elf1, and do it for k going from 1 from 2 to 16. So basically merge all the elves. And then output z1. You hit enter, the computer outputs this. And this is already the invariant of the trefoil. Here is the omega part. This is an invariant, what is written here. This is a not invariant. If you had written the trefoil in a different way and run the same procedure, you'd get the same answer. Okay? So, but this is the omega part. This is the L part, which I promised you is not interesting. This is the Q part, which is not interesting. Again, it's not interesting at the end, but it is interesting in all the intermediate stages. And then this is the P part, which is horrible. Still. And then there is an extraction procedure. So given a single elf with an omega, an L, a Q, and a P, you just define row one of the knot to be the constant term of P, where you set all the elf variables to zero, minus T times omega prime times omega cubed, prime meaning of differentiation with respect to T, divided by something ugly. And by the way, I should have said, it turns out that the omega is the Alexander polynomial. So as you compute this thing, but on the side, you end up computing the Alexander polynomial. You kind of must. It's a part of the computation. You have to compute the Alexander polynomial if you want to compute row one. So anyway, here it is implemented. And here it is evaluated on the z1 that I got from here, namely for the trefoil. So here is row one of the trefoil knot. It's as non-exciting as you can get, but you can repeat it for all knots or for knots with hundreds of crossings in principle, and you'll get various answers. So for example, I should have said that the polynomial you get here is always invariant under t goes to t inverse. So it's enough to write the positive coefficients part of it. So for the trefoil, the only term you need to write is t. So this is the end result, a single t. Not very exciting. For the unknot, you get 0. For the figure 8, you get 0 for 01. For the trefoil, you get t. For 5-1, you get 2t cubed plus 3t. And then the rest is not available for me on this screen, but it is available on your handout. So you get all sorts of complicated polynomials. Okay? That's the end of the story. Now some experimental results. So first of all, I've computed it for all knots with up to 12 crossings. And this is a log of the number of crossings versus log of computation time in seconds for all of these knots. And you know, since it's polynomial growth, if you take the log of both sides, you should get a linear function, and you get more or less linear function. So indeed, it's polytime computable. Now, the fact that the numbers that appear here are seconds have to do with the fact that my program is ridiculous. My expectation is that sooner or later, this will be swapped with milliseconds. Okay, so you really should be thinking that it's time, that it's quick. Then, here is the same for all torus knots with up to 48 crossings, and now it actually decomposes into several lines with different slopes, depending on the width of the torus knot. But again, they're all linear. It's still linear, okay? And again, for the big torus knots, the numbers here grow big, but again, you should be thinking of them as milliseconds, even though, to be honest, they are seconds. Okay? Power. So it doesn't really make sense to separate rho 1 from Alexander. It's the same invariant. It's just the two components of the same thing. Okay? So on the 250 knots with up to 10 crossings, the pair, Alexander and then rho 1, attains exactly 250 distinct values, namely it separates knots with up to 250 crossings. And this is better than the pair Hovanov-Homfli, which attains only 249 different values. To 11 crossings, yes?
Could I ask which one Hovanov-Homfli doesn't distinguish?
You can ask, but I don't know.
It's not on the table.
It's not on the table. I could find it out in 3 minutes of typing, but I don't know.
It would be
remember.
Interesting.
Okay.
It's not the purple pair.
Then, no, it's not the purple pair.
By the way, did you check the other one on the purple pair that you dropped? Maybe you get a,
no, no,
maybe you get a 250 first distinct value.
That would be lovely, but you would hate me, of course. But no, I did not check it. But I did run many, many tests. There is no question about the.
Isn't that astonishing that it does all 250 knots?
I think it is. I'm happy. Anyway, to 11 crossing it fails because there are 802 11 crossing knots. You said 800. You were wrong by two. No, wait. You said it doesn't matter. Anyway, there are 802.
800 before Cadron added the last two.
Oh,
I may have referred to.
Okay. Anyway, there are 802 knots. The pair omega rho 1 separates 788 of them. Hovanov and Homfli, Homfli PT separate 772, and for 12 crossings, these are the numbers. So it's powerful invariant. Here is a little bit of an aside. So up to 12 crossings, this is experimental. However, there is a theoretical reason why it should be true, and it will be proven, no doubt. So experimental, but with absolute certainty that it's true. You can get a genus bound out of rho 1. And in fact, this genus bound is sometimes better, sometimes worse, but sometimes better than the Alexander genus bound. So you actually get new topology out of it. Now, what I'm not telling you here is that for various complicated reasons, which I will not explain right now because it's minute 52, and how much do I have?
Take all of it.
No, I don't know how much how much time was I to have? I think 50 minutes, so I'm already...
Minus 5 minutes.
Oh.
The schedule, you have minus 5 minutes.
So I will not tell you that there are reasons to, or of all the invariants that I know, this one has the best chances of disproving ribbon equals slice. Because it's kind of a neighbor of Alexander on one sense, and it has various good properties, again, which I will not list and not tell you why they're important, but it has the best chance of separating ribbons from slice. So hopefully there will be more topology coming out of it. But this is basically being optimistic. Why does it work? So I think I'm running out of time, but there will be some Lie algebras that I will define in the next slide. And really, these pair, words and then formulas, using some PBW-style thing, represent, messy PBW-style thing, represents elements in the universal enveloping algebra of that Lie algebra, and at the generators, the crossings and the quap, represent things in the universal enveloping algebra that satisfy Young, Baxter, and all the equations that you need in order to get a knot invariant. So basically, this is kind of the quantum invariant associated with this Lie algebra G1 that I will define in a minute, except it's computed in a very different way. Instead of using representation theory, it's computed by using commutation relations in the universal enveloping algebra. So it's a completely different way. And again, had you been working with semi-simple Lie algebras, this would be totally hopeless. Now, what's the Lie algebra? Here it is. I mean, it's just, it's the Lie algebra generated by H, E prime, L, and F. E prime because E will get renormalized in a minute. H will become e to the t, no, e to the h will become t, and then, and it's central, so you can factor it out of all the formulas, and hence it didn't appear in most of what I did today. And then all the other relations are written here, and there is not much to say about it. Here are the relations, that's it. It's a solvable approximation of SL2. Here is abstractly how it arose using bi-algebras, etc. But the bi-algebra story is really the story that I told you right here. So, but said in fancier mathematics language. And I think I'll skip this, I'll skip that. And I should say that there is a huge to-do list. Well, okay. Rozansky and Overbay came to the same invariant by a completely different way, but by studying somehow one line in the Kohler-Jones polynomial. So really this is, I should have said, this invariant is actually dominated by the Kohler-Jones polynomial. So in some sense there is nothing new about it. The new thing is that you cannot compute the Kohler-Jones polynomial for anything of any big size, but you can compute this one for huge things. So this is the real new things. I already said the second point, and I think there are years of work ahead of me and ahead of us, me and Roland, and many papers to write, because there are lots and lots of open questions. But I don't have time to say anything about them. So I will end with happy birthday to Scott, plus my usual propaganda.
Any questions? Comments?
Yes.
Is it obvious that the rewriting is always going to help?
I have rewriting rules. They don't have to hold. You can continue rewriting indefinitely by going back and forth.
Right. But you have this condition that you halt your procedure when you get to a certain state. It's obvious you'll always get.
But I also told you how to, using the three rewriting rules, to get elf merges. So using the three rewriting rules, you can turn a pair of elves into a single elf. And by repeatedly doing this, you go from 16 elves to one elf, and then you're done. So I do have a path to the end, to the target. Sorry, Ken.
It's a beautiful table. Belongs on the internet. I take back
it's
what I said.
It's on the internet, of course.
I take back.
I do is on the internet before I do it. Yeah.
Your 802, I think, counts the trivial not, because I don't count the trivial not.
Okay. Maybe. Yes. Yeah.
So I know you said it's complicated, but can you say something about the connection with ribbon knots?
I said it in. Maybe I should have. Okay, I'll advertise. So much more is in other talks that I gave, and I tend to videotape every talk that I give. So the answer to your question would appear, for example, in the four-hour versions that I gave in Switzerland.
And
the URL is web/talks, where web is defined on the handout. But if I were to say it very, very, I don't know, the chair should tell me if I have time.
I think we should take a photo with the elf photo, photos of elves and the elf photos.
Okay, so my answer is it's in writing and on video in various places, but not.
All right. Thanks.
Yes?
You gave us some, in the plot of the experimental results of computation time versus number of crosses.
Yeah.
And you claim a polynomial function.
Yeah.
How does the actual formula, mathematical formula, gives you the time in terms of the size of the input? How does the formula look like?
Okay, so the reason why everything is polynomial time I've already indicated, because I only deal with quartic polynomials and never more. So that's the basic reasons. And then when you when you naively figure out the time, then for an, okay, also I should say that this isn't the most efficient way to compute it. So I did elf merges, but if you order the elf merges more carefully, you can be more quick, okay? You don't have to do them in the order that they appear. You can merge them in different orders, and then you get faster algorithm. And then at the end, I can reduce it to something like W to the power 4, no, W to the power 6. The complexity is W to the power 6 n squared, where n is the number of crossings, and w is the tangle width of the knot. So the narrowest you can draw it. Typically, w is roughly the square root of n, so the complexity becomes, if you substitute square root of n into here, it becomes n to the 5, which is one bit worse than Alexander. The Alexander polynomial is really n to the 4 if you use the same kind of procedure. In fact, if you use the exact same program but dropping all the p's, you compute the Alexander polynomial in n to the 4 time. So that's roughly the answer, n to the 5. Now, this is not doing anything fancy. So people in complexity theory will tell you that you can multiply polynomials faster than it appears to be. So if you use fancy stuff from complexity theory, you can probably reduce it even better, even more.
So this is not a lower bound?
No, this is an upper bound.
It's an upper, sorry.
Yeah, and this is roughly the complexity, n to the 5, but you can probably do a bit better. But this already means that it's computable. Okay? Again, the reality is, well, okay.
So
it computes.
So maybe you should follow my example and come towards the board. Draw, we put elves on the board, and let's think.